It was nearly 6 years later that I was to have my own experience with what seemed to be otherworldly sources. In 1963 I was living in Ossining, New York, commuting each day to New York City where I was working on an electronic invention which would help people with a hearing problem. On March 15 I came home from an exhausting day in the city with a splitting headache and, without eating dinner, fell asleep in a second-floor bedroom at the rear of the house. I slept for about 2 hours. When I awakened, I looked at the luminous dial of my wristwatch in the dark and saw that it was 9:40 p.m. I lay there, awake and fresh, thinking about getting up and having some dinner. From my position in bed I could see the wintry clear night sky, full of stars. Then suddenly among them appeared a bright light. My first thought was that an oncoming plane had just turned on its landing lights. I slowly got out of bed, keeping my eyes on the light, and walked to the window. I now saw that the light was stationary and was located just over the first hill to the west, which was about 300 yards from where I stood. The light was like a flattened egg in shape, about the size of a full moon and of a steady blue-green color. The color, in fact, was the same color as one sees in a mercury vapor street lamp. I stared at the light object. I began to have a profound feeling of the gravity of this moment. I knew that the light was very, very real, and it gave me the feeling of a living thing. Normally in this kind of situation I would have taken my movie camera and gone outdoors to take pictures of the thing I saw. But now I had no desire to prove anything or to document what I saw. This was for me pure experience. It was like nothing that had ever happened to me before, nor was there anything that I could associate with it. I stood there for 20 minutes, by clock time, staring unblinkingly at this light object. I saw that it was only light. There seemed to be nothing solid associated with it. I could see nothing inside of the light as I stared at it. Suddenly the light was out. There was no movement, it just went out. I stood there staring at the bright night sky for another hour, but the light did not return. After I had recovered from the emotional intensity of being in the presence of the light, I tried to analyze what this meant. I first thought of all the reports I had read about or had been told about concerning unidentified spacecraft. I concluded that what I had just seen and witnessed did not fit the general description that went with the most commonly reported types of UFOs. I recalled what Dr. Laughhead had given me as a description of the spacecraft he had seen. I again recalled what Peter Hercose had once described to me as flying saucers he had seen, or, the way he pronounced this phrase, flying sausages. None of these descriptions fit my experience. I finally concluded that what I had seen had to stand by itself, that I could not fortify it by getting assurance that others had also had the same experience. The experience to me was very real, and the memory of it stayed with me. But I talked to no one about it. It was too private to reveal and, besides, it had no objective corroboration. I simply filed it away in my memory. But this kind of experience was to recur in Brazil. I first heard of Arago, the Brazilian healer, from an intelligent, articulate doctor named Lauro Neiva, who practiced in Rio de Janeiro. Dr. Neiva told me that Arago was a man in his early 40s who performed major surgery on humans without using any known form of anesthesia, bleeding control, hemostasis, or antisepsis. I was told that Arago had become a court of last appeal for hopeless medical problems in Brazil and that his rate of success was phenomenal. On August 21, 1963, I set out from Rio de Janeiro for Arago's village, Congonhas do Campo, which was about 300 kilometers to the north of Rio in the state of Minas Gerais. Arago was of medium height with a powerful muscular build. He had a hearty outgoing manner which radiated confidence to all around him. Although I did not understand Portuguese, it was obvious that his speech had a rough peasant quality. I shall not go into details of his background or his present social situation because this material has been adequately covered in other writings. Too, I was warmly welcomed and given free rein to observe his work, to interview patients, and to ask any questions I wished. On August 22, I observed Arago handle about 200 patients over a period of 4 hours. Arago worked in a small dilapidated Espiritista church. First he addressed the assembled patients and said that he himself was not the healer but that he acted only as an agent for a higher power, which, he said, was the spirit of one Adolfo Fritz, who had died in Germany in 8. In order to assure patients that he would not harm anyone, he said he would demonstrate the safety of his work. He took by the shoulder a man standing next to him and without a word plunged a paring knife, a very sharp, 4-inch stainless steel blade with a cocobolo wood handle, toward the man's left eyeball. The knife was skillfully inserted under the upper eyelid, and the sharp point plunged deep into the eye socket. The patient was calm and relaxed, and when queried as to possible pain, he answered that he felt nothing. Arago then pressed the point of the knife up through the upper chamber of the eye socket so that, too, John G. Fuller, Arago, surgeon of the Rusty Knife, New York, T.Y. Crowell, 1974, with an appendix by Andrea Pugh Harridge, M.D. The point lifted the skin above the eye, supraorbital forehead area. Arago asked me to feel the point of the knife through the skin, which I did. I affirmed that I could palpate the sharp tip of the knife. This exercise lasted about 20 seconds. When the knife was withdrawn from the eye socket, I asked the patient how he felt. He replied that he felt normal. Examination of the eye did not reveal any laceration, redness, or other signs of irritation. I was stunned at this demonstration of surgical and medical power. For the rest of the 4 hours I watched Arago's mode of handling patients. The patients stood in a long line waiting to see Arago. When one stepped up, Arago looked up at him or her from his desk, asked no questions, and in a few seconds began a definitive treatment, either surgical or medical, on each of the 200 patients. He sent a dozen patients away, saying that their problems could easily be handled by any medical doctor. He performed eye surgery and ear surgery on 10 patients, each operation averaging about 30 seconds. He used the same knife on each patient and wiped it on his shirt after each operation. No attempt was made to give any anesthesia or hypnotic suggestion, no sterile precautions were used. Bleeding was minimal, and each patient walked out of the room by himself after surgery. The rest of the patients were given long complicated medical prescriptions which used proprietary pharmaceutical preparations from well-known drug houses. Arago never charged for his healing services, he worked at a full-time job as a civil servant to earn his living. I was in a state of shock as I witnessed his apparently successful handling of these patients while violating every rule of medicine and surgery in which I had been indoctrinated. I simply could not believe what I was seeing and experiencing. At the end of the day of August 22, 1963, I pondered how I could prove to myself and my colleagues that we were not hallucinating. It occurred to me that if I could persuade Arago to operate on a tumor on my right forearm, I could get a personal and realistic evaluation of what he was doing. I approached Arago with this request on the morning of August 23. And he cheerfully agreed to operate on me. I arranged for Jorge Rini to film my operation. I had a lipoma on the elbow over the right ulna head which measured by palpation about 0.5 inches x 1.2 inches x 1.4 inches. It had been there for 7 years and had been checked regularly by Sidney Krebs, M.D., of New York City, during the past 2 years. We appeared before Arago at 10 a.m. There were dozens of patients crowding the room. I rolled up my right sleeve. Arago asked if any of the surrounding patients could lend him a pocket knife. One man offered a knife, but Arago said it was too dull. Another man offered a Swiss Army knife. Arago said, "This is a good knife." Arago told me not to look at the surgery. I turned my head toward Rainey on my left, who was running the movie camera, and gave Osma, my translator, some advice about the lighting. At the same time I felt Arago grasp my arm at the tumor area with his left hand. All I could feel was something like a fingernail being pressed into the skin. Within 5 seconds Arago displayed an elongated egg-shaped tumor for all the patients to see and handed it to me with a pocket knife. I had felt no sensation of pain. When I looked at the wound, there was a trickle of blood from the incision, which was about a half inch long. Arrigo then said that Dr. Fritz had told him to make the following statement: "This is a demonstration only, so that people will believe. I think every doctor in Brazil should come here and do what you do. After the legal prosecution against me is over, you must come back, and I will do major surgery for you." Immediately after the surgery, I took black and white pictures of the tumor and the knife. I then asked Altamiro, Arrigo's assistant, to place a dressing on the wound. He took some unsterile gauze squares and taped them over the wound. I felt that my surgery was not adequate for scientific purposes, as I was not able to observe it properly, nor did I experience enough significant data points to evaluate it. However, given the unsterile conditions of the surgery, I would have a real test of Arrigo's powers if the wound did not get infected. Hence I determined not to use any antiseptics on the wound nor to use any antibiotics, in order to test the postoperative cause with respect to possible infection. I therefore changed the bandage once a day so that I could photograph the healing and infective course. By the third day the wound had healed by primary intention, and not one drop of pus had appeared. I did not develop any symptoms of blood poisoning or tetanus. By the fourth day I dispensed with the bandage. With this evidence I was now convinced that Arrigo had extraordinary powers in surgery, bacterial control, and anesthesia. 6 days later I visited Jorge Rini in Sao Paulo and saw the developed movies of my surgery. The film clearly proved that there had been an operation, and thus personal and mass hallucinations were ruled out. The film showed that Arrigo had made 6 saw-like strokes of the knife through my skin to make the incision. This alone should have been painful. And strangely enough, the tumor popped out of my arm without Arrigo having dissected it. The entire procedure lasted 5 seconds. It is now 10 years since the operation. The surgical scar remains, the tumor is still in a bottle of alcohol, there have been no complications. In September 1967 I went to Brazil to continue my studies of Arrigo. I had seen him many times since that operation in 1963, and it had never occurred to me to ask him for personal help. One day as I was working with Arrigo, he suddenly fumed to me and said, "You have atosclerosis." I replied, "I don't know about that, but I have a chronic infection and drainage in my left ear from a cholesteatoma." Arrigo said, "Yes, you have had that for a long time, but the atosclerosis is new. Check it when you get home. I will give you a prescription that will cure both of your problems." There is not much need to explain the items in the prescription except to state that the first drug was an eardrop solution, the second was a bile salt, and the third was gabromycina, a primitive form of streptomycin, which had largely been dropped from use by physicians. The prescription involved 2 successive treatments. When I resumed to the States, I had the audiologist in my own laboratory run a hearing test on me with an audiometer. When the test was done, she volunteered the diagnosis, "You have atosclerosis." I checked the audiogram. Arrigo was right, I did have atosclerosis, a hardening of the bony tissue over the stapes in the middle ear chamber. I decided then and there to start Arrigo's prescription. Because of my odd working hours, it was easiest for me to give myself the gabromycina injection just before I went to bed each night. I started the first treatment series on October 7, 1967, including the injection of the gabromycina once a day. By October 14 I had developed a reaction to this form of streptomycin. I had a swelling and tenderness of my hands and palms and on my feet and toes. Therefore, I had to stop the injections and wait for the allergic reaction to go away. By October 25 I was in good enough shape to begin the second treatment. In my opinion it was too dangerous to try to continue with the streptomycin. Therefore, I never did fully complete the first treatment. I finished the second treatment on January 11, 1968. I was now free of the ear drainage problem that had plagued me all of my life, and have continued so to this day. Over the next 6 months my audiograms showed that my atosclerosis had disappeared. My hearing improved. I want to make one other point here, for the record, I never told another human being that I had not finished the first treatment because of an allergic reaction. See page 159. In early 1968 I was busily engaged in preparations to lead a team of medical researchers to Brazil to study Arago. We arrived in Congonhas do Campo on the afternoon of May 22, 1968. To house our group we had rented a large fazenda, or ranch, some 2 miles out of the village. As the sun set, we all assembled on the huge lawn to observe the incredible brilliance of the wintry stars. The night was cold and the air very dry. At 6 p.m. one of our researchers, John Lawrence, noted a bright white light moving across the sky from south to north. He brought it to our attention because, as he explained, it was not a plane or a satellite. John could make this statement with some authority because he worked for the Astroelectronics Division of RCA in New Jersey, designing and building satellites for NASA. For about 6 minutes we watched this light move slowly overhead, resembling a very bright star. It was impossible to determine its distance from us. Then it suddenly winked out in mid-course and was gone. We discussed what it could possibly have been and concluded that it was an unknown type of aerial light. The owner of the fazenda, Walter de Freitas, joined us, and we told him what we had seen and asked for clarification of our observation. He laughed and told us the following story. You see, the common folk around here always see what you just saw, mostly between May and August. They call them rivers of gold in the sky because they believe that these lights will lead you to gold. I don't believe these superstitions, but I have an idea why they believe such things. One day, 2 years ago, I was standing where we are now, and I saw one of these lights slowly come down from the sky. It landed about 500 meters from here, in that direction by the river. It was just after sunset, as it is now. I could see pretty well in the dark, so I started to walk toward the light to see what it was. When I came to within 50 meters, I could clearly see moving figures under what looked like a metal craft, looking like a giant lens. I still am not sure whether the creatures were more like people or more like animals. But I could see and hear that they were digging in the earth. As I got closer, about 30 meters away, three or four of these figures suddenly disappeared into the metal hull which I now saw was standing on legs. The lens hull shot out fire and smoke and rose straight up in the air. When I examined the ground where the metal hull had been, I saw many small fresh holes. I went there the next morning looking to see if there was any gold, but I didn't find any. We quizzed Walter for a few minutes, and then Dr. Luis Cortes called out, "Hey, there is another one!" Again we saw a very bright white light at an indeterminate distance, going slowly overhead from north to south. It, too, lasted for a long time, 12 minutes, and then winked out. I immediately set up my Hasselblad camera, but I had only an 80mm lens. But fortunately I had a Polaroid back for this camera and very fast 3000AZ black and white film, which allowed me the possibility of getting some pictures. I set my camera on a stable tripod, and we all sat watching the skies. Fortunately, being in the country, there were absolutely no streetlights around to mar either the viewing or the photography. Soon another light appeared, moving slowly from east to west, and I was able to photograph it, as a streak, through time exposure. Moreover, the film was so sensitive that I was able to get a background star map photo as a reference frame. We set up a night watch, and I was able to get three more photographs that night. After comparing our collective observations, we all agreed unanimously that the lights we had seen and photographed were indeed unidentified aerial light effects. During the next few days we discussed for the first time the theory that Arago's powers may not be due to a Dr. Fritz, but to some intelligent beings associated with spacecraft of extraterrestrial origin. This seemed to be a perfectly logical hypothesis, but, of course, there was no way to test it. We spoke to Arago about this possibility, and he just laughed away the question. For the next 3 years I made plans to undertake a concentrated study of Arago's powers, but other work intervened. At about 11 a.m. on January 11, 1971, I was working in my office at Intellectron Corporation in New York City when the telephone rang. Normally my secretary, Lorraine Shaw, would pick up the phone first. But this time, for no reason, I picked it up, and a woman whose name I don't recall blurted out the following, "I am looking for Dr. Pugh Harridge." I replied, "This is he speaking." "Dr. Pugh Harridge, I just got a telephone call from a TV station in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, asking for you to make a comment on the death of Arago. Would you please repeat that?" "I don't think I clearly heard what you said," I stuttered. She repeated her statement. I said, "Are you sure of what you are saying, that Arago is dead?" She replied that all she knew was what had been relayed to her. I told her I could not then reply because of my shocked state. If she would give me her name and telephone number, I would call her back. This she did, and I wrote these items down on my desk calendar pad. I sat back in my chair. It did not seem possible for Arago, the greatest healer in the world, to be dead. He was too young, too vital. Besides, he was the hope of thousands, perhaps millions, of people who looked to him as the witness for higher powers. There must be a mistake, I thought. I will have to check this out myself. I called the Brazilian consulate in New York, and they had no such news. I called the Brazilian embassy in Washington, they had no such news. I called the various press services, they had no such news. Finally by 4:30 p.m. I called friends in Brazil, who finally confirmed the dread news that Arago had been killed that very morning in an auto accident. I proceeded to return the phone call from the woman, and looked at my desk calendar pad. Her name and phone number were not there, the sheet was clean. I thought I had perhaps written the information somewhere else. But I could not find any such paper. I checked with my secretary, she had not heard the phone ring at 11:00 a.m. nor had she logged any incoming calls at that time. Then I began to worry, had I really received the call as I remembered it? Perhaps she would call me again. But she never did call back. In any case, I was personally despondent over the loss of Arago. Humanity had lost its great luminary. It was as though the sun had gone out. The shock was so deep to me that I decided to go on a 14-day fast and re-examine all of my life and weigh the meaning of Arago, both in life and in death. During my fast my sorrow was lightened by information I received from Dr. Juscelino Kubitschek, the former president of Brazil. Kubitschek said that he had visited Arago 2 weeks before his death, and in the most simple and casual way Arago had said, "I do not like to say this, Mr. President, but I will soon die a violent death." The former president was shocked and disturbed. "You don't mean that," he said. Arago nodded and repeated in a sad, soft tone, "I am sure I will die violently very soon. So I say goodbye to you with sadness. This is the last time we will meet." Later Arago said to Gabriel Cater, editor of the local paper, "O Profeta, I am afraid, Gabriel, that my mission on Earth is finished. I will leave soon." But 2 years later I was to learn from John G. Fuller, who wrote a book about Arago, that he had received a report that Arago had been killed at exactly 12:15 p.m. in the car crash. Since the time in Congonhas is 1 hour earlier than New York, he had been killed at 1:15 a.m. New York time. How did I get the news of his death at least 15 minutes before the event occurred? This mystery was not solved until my experiences with Uri in Israel. But the answer will be given later in this story. The knowledge of Arago's foreknowledge of his death helped me a great deal. That his death was not the result of blind chance eased my pain. Near the end of my fast, I came to some strong conclusions. The first was that I had failed both Arago and humanity by not completing my studies of Arago's healing work. I realized that I should have dropped my other work in 1963 and concentrated all of my efforts on Arago. I was sure there would never be another Arago in my lifetime. But if there were, I would not fail the next time. I looked back over the 10 years since I had moved to New York. I had become a slave to my company, to my inventions, and to a complex and costly way of life. While it was true that I had been issued some 50 patents for my inventions, which promised to help many people with deafness, I could not really make any more creative contributions in this area. Others could carry on what I had started. But most of all, I wanted to get into the full-time study of the mysterious powers of the human mind. One day I made my decision. I would resign from all my duties and jobs from foundations, companies, and laboratories and give myself 2 years in which to find a new place in full-time research on the mind. When I informed my family and colleagues of my decision, they tried to talk me out of it. But I was determined in my course. By April 1, 1971, I had freed myself of all these ties and began my new way of life. I had two goals. One was to develop a theoretical base for all of my mind researches, and the other was to find human beings with great psychic talents who would cooperate as research subjects. Chapter 1. Yuri means light. As far as Itzhak and Marguerite Geller were concerned, the birth of their first son, Yuri, on December 20, 1946, in Tel Aviv, was a moment of peace in an unending struggle for survival. Itzhak had fled from Hungary in 1940 before the Holocaust consumed Europe. Upon landing in Palestine, he had worked on a kibbutz, happy to be alive and free. When the British finally decided in 1942 to allow Jews to fight in the Allied cause to help defeat Nazi Germany, Itzhak was one of the first to volunteer. He was trained as a tanker and fought with great courage and ingenuity against Rommel's forces in Africa. Itzhak Geller, like so many others, believed that he had a covenant with God by living in the promised land until God, in his perfect wisdom, revealed to his chosen ones why they had been chosen. If a man settled on a piece of land in Palestine, and if by sunrise he had established a water supply and a dwelling, Turkish common law gave him the rights of a settler. Itzhak and his friends purchased a piece of scrub desert from a sheikh near Beersheba. The sheikh felt sure that the land could not be settled because the nearest water line was a mile away. The planning for this new Jewish settlement went on for months. In pitch darkness, the young men and women practiced assembling their prefabricated huts and laying down a water line that would not leak. They loaded their new community on 6 trucks and under cover of darkness arrived at their land. When the sun arose the next morning, it saw a brand new kibbutz complete with huts, fences, watchtowers, and a precious water line. The weary kibbutzniks proudly patrolled their settlement in the searing heat of that long first day. The Arabs came up with their flocks and tents and just stared at this miracle in the desert. There was no hostility in the air. The ancient law had been honorably fulfilled. But Itzhak and his friends learned that if they did not patrol their land 24 hours a day, they would be killed by anti-Jewish fanatics. They became a part of the home defense effort called the Haganah. This was a primitive home guard militia defending land, home and family, and especially children. Some of Itzhak's friends who were political-minded joined a secret military group called the Palmach. The Haganah was solely concerned with defense. The Palmach was concerned with preemptive attacks, reprisals, and sabotage. Itzhak was neither bloodthirsty nor war-minded and served only in the Haganah. By 1949, the local outbreaks of violence had become more dangerous each day, and the little world of Israel had no peace for the baby Yuri. Itzhak found himself spending more and more of his time in soldiering and training others to be soldiers. The stress and strain was beginning to take its toll. Unlike many Jews, he could find no solace and peace in reading the Bible, nor in prayers. He was a man of action, and when he was troubled, he found some release by going to another woman. One day he found a young woman who gave him more peace than did his wife, Marguerite. And Marguerite was so heartbroken that she took young Uri and left home. Itzhak, too, was heartbroken. But now it was a matter of personal survival. Marguerite moved to the budding town of Tel Aviv near the old Arab city of Jaffa, biblical Joppa. She found a job as a seamstress, and Uri spent the day in the company of a neighbor and her children. He loved this kindly lady, but she shouted too often and too loudly at her unruly brood. Uri eventually found a place where he could be happy in the midst of all of the bustling humanity around him. Across the street from his apartment was a stately Arab estate. It was fully a square block in size with a grey shuttered villa in one corner. It was surrounded by a high wooden fence that screened it off completely from eyes on the street. One day, Yuri, in trying to peek through the fence, found that a vertical board gave way as though it were hinged at the top, and he stepped into what seemed to him a magic world. He saw near him a pool with fish in it,